right, Ronnie, what is up? We hope you guys had a wonderful first week of the new year. Mine was subpar at best. Was not the best week, but I hope yours was better than mine. How about yours? What was yours like?
Mine was good. Busy. Busy beginning 2022.
Busy. Well, we hope you made it a productive one, whether it was good or bad. But this week's episode 2 of our true crime series, Killer Couple Edition. If you haven't listened to last week's episode about the Makins and the West, definitely pause this episode right now. Pause it right now. Go listen to episode 1 and then come back and meet us here. But let's not waste any more time. I want you to grab your drinks, grab your snack,
and let's get into it.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God.
Before Mackenzie dives into her case this week, I'm going to give you guys the trigger warning like we always do. So this episode deals with violent, gruesome, and triggering events, including sexual assault, animal abuse, murder, and more, that may not be suitable for all listeners. The information for this podcast episode is based off of extensive research done on cases by both of us. We at Cosign Podcast do not intend any disrespect to the victims or family members of the victims involved in these crimes. Listener discretion is advised.
Okay, before I get into the details of this case, I wanted to note something pretty cool. And if you're new here, Sam and I not only find true crime fascinating, but astrology as well, among other things. But let me climb down astrology's rabbit hole for a moment, and I promise I'll make it quick. So you know how the FBI has an entire team dedicated to psychologically profiling murderers, right? Well, maybe they should use astrology instead. It's cheaper and bizarrely on point. Okay, stay with me. Let me explain. In the zodiac, the 12 signs are divided into three groups by something called modality. Each sign is either a fixed sign, mutable sign, or a cardinal sign, and each of these modalities has a different set of personality traits that go along with it. Gemini, Virgo, Sagittarius, and Pisces are known as mutable signs, meaning their signs fall at the end of a season. Gemini falls at the end of spring, Virgo at the end of summer, Sagittarius at the end of fall, and Pisces at the end of winter. Back in 2008, a Dutch statistician looked at the birth charts of almost 300 serial killers and found that serial killers are frequently born with celestial factors in mutable signs. So what are these traits of the mutable signs? Well, they're known to be adaptable and frantically indecisive. Sorry, Virgo. They're like chameleons, right? Experiencing episodic and frequent changes throughout their lives. Combine that with these signs' energies and personalities, and you have a recipe for people living double lives. Geminis are symbolized by twins and known for having multiple sides or hidden personalities, a charming outer persona and a darker, disturbed inner one. It's a real possibility. Virgos are meticulous and systematic. They also live for patterns and routine. Serial killers tend to commit acts that follow a predictable behavior pattern. And Virgos are also very good at cleaning up after themselves. Sagittarius are charismatic and thrive on adventure. It makes sense that these thrill-seeking signs might be more likely to take a chance on going through with a heinous act. They are also impulsive and spontaneous and don't always think things through. And Pisces. Allegedly, Pisces are empathetic, but that empathy could backfire. Since they have the ability to feel collective pain, they can get overwhelmed and turn inward as a way of a coping mechanism. So round up a few of America's most notorious serial killers and you'll get Mr. Ted Bundy, he's a Sagittarius, Jeffrey Dahmer, he's a Gemini, John Wayne Gacy, a Pisces, Andrew Cunanan, Virgo, son of Sam David Berkowitz, he's a Gemini, Richard the Night Stalker Ramirez, a Pisces, Boston Strangler Albert DeSavo, a Virgo, Randy Kraft, a Pisces, Larry Eiler, a Sagittarius, and BTK Dennis Rader, also a Pisces.
That's wild. That's so interesting. I love it.
All right, Sam. Are you ready for this case I'm bringing you this week?
I don't know, to be honest, after the baby killers last week.
Well, I'm talking about murder in the first degree. Are you ready? Let's start with Carol Ann. Carol Ann Fugate was born July 30th, 1943. In Lincoln, Nebraska, she lived with her mother and stepfather. In 1956, at the age of 13, she formed a relationship with Charles Starkweather, a high school dropout 5 years her senior. They met through Carol Ann's sister Barbara, who was dating Charles's friend, Bob Von Busch. Starkweather worked as a truck unloader at the Western Union newspaper warehouse. There's not much on Carol Ann, but there's a crap ton on Charles. So let's dig into him, okay? Charles Raymond Starkweather, often called Charlie, was born November 24th, 1938, in Lincoln, Nebraska. He was the third of seven children from Guy and Helen Starkweather. The Starkweathers were a working-class family, and his father, Guy, was a mild-mannered carpenter who was often unemployed due to suffering from rheumatoid arthritis in his hands. During Guy's periods of unemployment, Helen supplemented the family's income as working as a waitress. Though the family was poor, they managed. Charles attended Saratoga Elementary School, Irving Junior High School, and Lincoln High School. In contrast to his family, Starkweather later recalled nothing positive of his time at school. He was born with a mild birth defect that caused his legs to bow at the knees, and he also suffered from a speech impediment, which led to constant bullying and teasing by his classmates.
This seems to be a common factor in all of our serial killers.
When they were bullied?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As he grew older and stronger, the only subject that Charles excelled at was gym, or PE, as we call it down here in the South, where he found his physical outlet for his rage against those who bullied him. He then began to bully those who once picked on him. Eventually, he felt rage against anyone he disliked. After watching Rebel Without a Cause, Charles became obsessed with actor James Dean, who, as you know, played the lead role and started dressing like the character and imitating him. In this period as a young teenager, Charles went from being one of the most well-behaved teenagers in the community to one of the most troubled. His high school friend, Bob Von Busch, would later recall, and I quote, "He could be the kindest person you've ever seen. He would do anything for you if he liked you. He was a hell of a lot of fun to be around. Everything was one big joke to him. But he had this other side. He could be mean as hell, cruel. If he saw some poor guy on the street who was bigger than he was and better looking or better dressed, he would try to take the poor bastard down to his size." End quote. And by the time Charles dropped out of school, his parents and family were reportedly afraid of him due to his physical violent outbursts. So as I said before, Charles and Carol Ann were introduced to each other through Carol Ann's sister. She was 13 and he was 18. Charles dropped out during his senior year of high school and was working at Western Union Newspaper Warehouse. He sought employment there because the warehouse was located near Whittier Junior High School in Lincoln, which is where Carol Ann was a student. Given his work schedule, Charles began to visit Carol Ann every day after school. Charles taught Carol Ann how to drive, and one day she crashed his 1949 Ford into another car. However, Charles's father, Guy, was the registered owner of that vehicle. He paid the damages but argued with his son about it. Refusing to condone his son's behavior, Guy banished Charles from the family home. The young man quit his job at the warehouse and became a garbage collector for minimum wage. He began developing a nihilistic worldview, which is rejecting all religious and moral principles and the belief that life is meaningless. He believed that his current situation was the final determinant of how he would live the rest of his life, striving only to satisfy his biological needs and acquire power over others. He used his time on the garbage route to begin plotting bank robberies. He settled on a personal philosophy, which he lived by the remainder of his time, which is, dead people are all on the same level. What a philosophy.
It's a little morbid.
So the 1958 murder spree that I'm about to get into was not the first time that Charles killed. 1 year earlier, on November 30th, 1957, Charles became angry at Robert Colvert, who was a service station attendant in Lincoln, for refusing to sell him a stuffed animal on credit. He returned several times during the night to purchase small items until finally brandishing a shotgun and forcing Colvert to give him $100 from the till.
Over $100.
He drove Colvert to a remote area where he struggled over the gun, injuring Colvert before Charles killed him with several shots.
Wow.
So on January 21st, 1958, Charles went to Carol Ann's house to pick her up. Her mother and stepfather, Velda and Marion Bartlett, told him to stay away. He fatally shot them, then hit Carol Ann's baby sister, Betty Jean, causing blunt force trauma, strangled, and then stabbed her to death. She was 2 years old. Carol Ann claimed she came home to find Charles there alone, waiting for her with a gun. She said he told her that her family was being held hostage and that if she did exactly as he said, her family would be safe. The pair remained in the house until January 27th, turning away all visitors, which made Carol Ann's relatives extremely suspicious. The bodies were later found behind the house.
So they literally stayed there for six days with the bodies.
Yep. Oof. The police were originally alerted by Carol Ann's grandmother, but it was too late. Charles and Carol Ann had already fled to a farmhouse of 70-year-old August Meyer, one of Carol Ann's family's friends. Charles then killed him with a shotgun blast to the head, and he also killed his dog.
Okay, it's one thing to kill people.
To kill the dog.
Really?
I know. Fleeing the area, the pair drove their car into mud and abandoned the vehicle. Thinking they were in need of help, Robert Jensen and Carol King, two local teenagers, stopped to give them a ride. Charles forced them to drive into an abandoned storm cellar in Bennett, Nebraska. He shot Robert Jensen in the back of the head. He attempted to rape Carol King, but was unable to do so. He then became angry with her and fatally shot her as well. Starkweather later admitted to shooting Jensen, but claimed that Carol Ann was the one who shot Carol King. However, Carol Ann said she had stayed in the car the entire time. After the two murdered Robert and Carol, the two fled Bennett, Nebraska in Robert's car. Charles and Carol Ann then drove to a wealthy section of Lincoln, Nebraska, where they entered the home of industrialist named C. Ward and his wife Clara. Charles stabbed their maid to death, her name was Lillian, then waited for Mr. Ward and his wife to return home. Charles killed their family dog by breaking its neck to keeping it from alerting the Wards when they returned. Mrs. Ward is the one who arrived home first and was also stabbed to death. Charles later admitted to having thrown a knife at Clara originally, but insisted that Carol Ann was the one who stabbed her numerous times, which is what killed her. When Mr. Ward returned home that evening, Charles shot and killed him. Charles and Carol Ann filled Ward's black 1956 Packard with stolen jewelry from the house and fled Nebraska entirely.
What's your plan if you steal their car? What's your plan?
I have no idea. The murders of the Wards and their maid caused an uproar in Lancaster County, so law enforcement agencies in the region sent their officers on a house-to-house search for the perpetrators. The governor also contacted the Nebraska National Guard, and the Lincoln Chief of Police called for a block-by-block search of that city. After several sightings of Charles and Carol Ann were reported, the Lincoln Police Department were accused of incompetence for being unable to capture the two. I know, imagine being that police department.
Right.
So needing a new car because of the Ward's Packard having been identified, the couple came upon a traveling salesman named Merle Collison sleeping in his Buick along the highway outside Douglas, Wyoming on January 29th, 1958. After Merle was awakened, he was fatally shot. Charles later accused Carol Ann of performing a coup de grace, which is basically the final blow given to a wounded person or animal, after his shotgun jammed. Charles claimed that Carol Ann was the most trigger-happy person he had ever met. And of course, Carol Ann denied ever having killed anyone. Merle Collison's car had a parking brake, which was something new to Charles because the cars prior to this did not have a parking brake. While he attempted to drive away, the car stalled because the brake had not been released. He tried to restart the engine, and while doing so, a passing motorist named Joe Sprinkle had stopped to help. Charles threatened him with the rifle, and an altercation ensued. And at that moment, Sheriff Deputy William Romer arrived on scene. Carol Ann ran to him, yelling something to the effect of, "It's Starkweather! He's gonna kill me!" Charles drove off and was involved in a car chase with three officers exceeding speeds over 100 miles per hour. A bullet fired by one of the officers shattered the windshield and flying glass cut Charles deep enough to cause bleeding. He stopped and surrendered. Two of the officers involved in the chase said, and I quote, "He thought he was bleeding to death. That's the only reason he stopped. That's the kind of yellow son of a bitch he is." End quote. 10 people were murdered by the end of this spree. 10. And 2 dogs.
I love how the women pretend they're so innocent, but they be the most brutal ones.
Mm-hmm. So let's move to the trial and the sentencing portion of this, okay? Charles chose to be extradited from Wyoming back to Nebraska. He and Carol Ann arrived there in late January 1958, and he believed that either state was going to execute him either way. He was not aware, however, that Wyoming's governor at the time opposed the death penalty. Charles first said that he had kidnapped Carol Ann and that she had nothing to do with the murders. However, he changed his story on several occasions, and he later testified against her at her own trial, saying that she was a willing participant. That's how you know. Mm-hmm. It wasn't love. That man didn't love you, and you didn't love him.
Mm-hmm.
Carol Ann has always maintained that Charles was holding her hostage by threatening to kill her family, claiming she was completely unaware that they were already dead.
Whatever.
The judge over her trial did not believe that she was held hostage, as he determined that she had numerous opportunities to escape. When Charles was first taken to Nebraska Penitentiary, he said that he believed that he was supposed to die. He said if he was going to be executed, then Carol Ann should be also. Charles was convicted for the murder of Robert Jensen, the only murder for which he was tried.
Wow.
On May 23rd, 1958, he was sentenced to death. And 1 month later, on June 25th, Charles was executed in the electric chair at Nebraska State Penitentiary in Lincoln, Nebraska at 12:04 a.m. This was 17 months after the spree. Charles was 20 years old.
1 month later? That's really fast. They wanted to wipe out his memory as quickly as possible then.
He did not sit on death row for long.
No.
Charles gave no last words. But in a letter from prison to his parents, he wrote, "But Dad, I'm not real sorry for what I did, because the first time me and Carol have sick, S-I-C, more fun." I don't know what that means. I don't think he was really smart, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, his execution by electric chair was the last execution in Nebraska until 1994, when Harold Lamont Otte was executed for murder. What, 40-something years? It's crazy. But following the execution, Charles was buried in Lincoln, as are five of his victims, including Mr. and Mrs. Ward. Carol Ann was sentenced to life imprisonment at Nebraska Correctional Center for Women in York, Nebraska. Her sentence was then reduced in 1976 due to a Supreme Court ruling that life imprisonment for minors was unconstitutional. Considered to be a model prisoner, Carol Ann was paroled in 1976 after only serving 17 years. She lived in Michigan for a while after being paroled. Following her release, she worked as a janitorial assistant until she retired. After the release, in 2007, Carol Ann married Frederick Clare, a machinist who also worked as a weather observer for the National Weather Service. Their most recent city of residence was Hillsdale, Michigan. Carol Ann was seriously injured in August 2013 in a single vehicle accident. Her husband was driving their sport utility vehicle when it went off the road and overturned, which he died at the scene. Carol Ann, going by her married name of Carol Ann Clare, was denied a pardon by the Nebraska Parole Board in February 2020. Her pardon application was supported by relatives of the murder victims. She maintained her innocence in the 1958 slayings and requested a pardon to alleviate the burden of being known as a convicted killer.
Oh, so sorry.
Mm-hmm. Her pardon was denied because the role of a pardon is to restore a felon's rights, not to absolve them of crimes.
Right.
This case has continuously been studied and analyzed by criminologists and psychologists as a case study for spree killers in an attempt to understand their motivations. It also became notorious as one of the earlier crime scandals that reached national prominence, with the media outlets covering the case at the time openly condemning Starkweather. So I have a few pop culture references, because I know last episode we gave a few. So in 1996, Peter Jackson film called The Frighteners, it features central plot elements with the characters almost identical to Charles and Carol Ann, who commit a murder spree. The 13th Step, which is an episode of Criminal Minds, it aired on January 11th, 2011. It depicts newlyweds on a North Dakota, Montana killing spree, similar to Charles and Carol Ann.
When you were reading this, I was like, this is a Criminal Minds
episode. Sounds very familiar.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a Bruce Springsteen song, it was a 1982 song called Nebraska, is a first-person narrative based on the Starkweather murders.
Wow.
Uh-huh. And then Nebraska-based electropop trio called Icky Blossoms also features a song called Starkweather on their self-titled debut album. It is narrated from Charles's point of view and includes references to his killing of Carolyn's family.
Wow.
So, mm-hmm. So, what have we learned? Right? In 1956, 13-year-old Carol Ann and 18-year-old Charles Starkweather meet. In 1958, they begin their killing spree, killing 10 people. But however, Charles has killed 11 people and two dogs, unfortunately. Over the span of 60 days, Charles and Carol Ann flee from Nebraska to Wyoming and then back to Nebraska. After killing 5 more people, they were apprehended, both convicted of murder. Charles was sentenced to death basically immediately. As soon as his trial was over.
Literally.
And then Carol Ann served 17 years until she was paroled and lived out her life. Carol Ann was also the youngest female in United States history to have been tried for first-degree murder. Carol Ann, surprisingly, was a Leo. But Charles was a Sagittarius. Obviously, I can't show you the pictures, but I'm going to post these pictures on our podcast Instagram just so you guys can see what they look like. Because they don't look like murderers, which is the scariest part.
Right. She's actually pretty.
Yeah. So that is murder in the first degree.
Oh, one thing. You want to know what I noticed?
What?
Back, we're, the first 4 cases we've done in first episode and this episode, the guys always get put to death and the women always get off somehow. That's some bullshit. And I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry. That's some BS.
I think back in the day, they probably felt like, oh my gosh, she would have had to have been manipulated at some point.
Right.
You never know. Sometimes the men are manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
And they be doing it just for some below the belt action.
We're back. Okay, so I'm not going to reread the trigger warning, but I am going to reiterate it. There are some cases that are just more brutal than others and harder to talk about and hear about. And this case is definitely one of them. So listener discretion is advised. So this is the story of David Parker Ray, aka the Toy Box Killer, and his girlfriend, Cindy Hendy. Which, I was trying to say that with a straight face. So to understand how a couple could commit such horrible crimes together like these two did, it's important to take a look at their backgrounds. So we're going to start with David. And David Parker Ray was born in Bella, New Mexico on November 6th, 1939. He's a Scorpio. Mm. He was abandoned by his mother and father at the age of 10 and was sent to live with his grandparents. Little is known about his childhood, but we do know he was regularly beaten by his father before he was abandoned by them. He also had a sister, but the two were split up when his grandmother passed away. And I couldn't find anything about her, not even her name. He was described as a withdrawn and socially awkward child. As a kid, David was bullied by his peers for his shyness around girls. These insecurities drove him to drink and abuse drugs. And as for Cindy, she claimed she was also abused as a child, but was not believed by her family when she came forward at the age of 11. And like David, Cindy had also become severely withdrawn. So I wanted to just talk about this for a second, because, you know, we saw similar situations in the killer couples that we did in our last episodes, the West and the Makins. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say, if someone is sexually abused, emotionally abused, or psychologically abused as a child, or all three, God forbid, that's definitely going to have a huge impact on them. And I'm not saying people automatically become serial killers because of it, because that's definitely not the case. But it is proven, and we've talked about this in our mental health episodes, severe trauma changes the way that the brain functions. So imagine how much more so that happens in a developing child going right through something like this.
Right.
So, I mean, and we all know dealing with these types of abuse as adults is hard enough as it is, and especially to try to move forward from. So I really can't even begin to imagine processing that type of trauma as a little kid and trying to understand what's happening to me, especially when it comes from close family members or even your own parents betraying the trust.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and we were just talking before we started this episode, we've seen this across the board with the cases we've researched. The one thing they all have in common is they had very tough home lives, whether physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse was involved, and they also all were bullied really bad in school. I think that's important to note. So Cindy ended up dropping out of school, right, at the age of 15. She gave birth to a son at the age of 16 and had two more children from two different men by her late 20s. When her youngest hit the age of 10, Cindy felt she could no longer raise her children, so she sent them to live and be raised by their grandparents. After that, she eventually relocated from Seattle to Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. And yes, Truth or Consequences is the name. If you hear me refer to it as TRC, that's what the locals call it for short. This is when she met David Parker Ray, who was 20 years older than her at 57, which would mean she was 37 at the time. David served in the U.S. Army, receiving an honorable discharge at the end of his enlistment, and ended up becoming a mechanic. He was married and divorced four times in his life and had a 31-year-old daughter named Jessie Ray from his third marriage, who he was really close with. It's believed that David began his killing spree sometime during the mid-1950s, which only came to light with the escape of Cynthia Vigil in 1999.
Wow.
So on March 19th, 1999, 22-year-old Cynthia Vigil, who was a prostitute, was working in a parking lot in Albuquerque, New Mexico, when a man claimed to be an undercover cop told her she was under arrest for solicitation of sex work and put her in the back of his car. "He told me I was under arrest and he put handcuffs on me," she said. The man was David Parker Ray, and he brought her to his nearby soundproof trailer, which he called his toy box. He then chained her to a homemade gynecologist-type table in the center of the trailer, and over the next 3 days, raped and tortured her with help from his girlfriend and accomplice, Cindy. The two of them used whips, medical instruments, electric shock, and sexual instruments to torture Cynthia. Before her torture, she said David would play a cassette tape with a recording detailing exactly what he was going to do to her. On the cassette, David explained that she was to refer to him only as master and the woman with him as mistress, and never to speak unless spoken to first. He went on to explain exactly how he would rape and torture her. "The way he talked, I didn't feel like this was his first time," she said in a later interview. "It was like he knew what he was doing. He told me I was never going to see my family again, and he told me he would kill me like all the others." Mm. On the third day of her torture, while David was at work, Cindy accidentally left the keys to Cynthia's restraints on a table near where she was chained while she left the room. Seizing the opportunity, Cynthia went for the keys and was able to free her hands. Cindy attempted to stop her, but Cynthia stabbed her in the neck with an instrument when she approached. She ran out of the trailer completely naked, wearing only a slave collar and padlock chains. Dispatchers received a series of calls reporting a woman who was frantically trying to stop cars on a street for help. In desperation, she knocked on the door of a nearby mobile home. The owner of the house brought Cynthia in and called the police, who promptly arrested both David and Cindy. So, after arresting David, the police gained a warrant to search his home and trailer, and what they found was extremely disturbing. His toy box contained a custom-built gynecologist-type chair in the middle of the room with electrodes to administer electric shocks. There was also a mirror mounted to the ceiling, so his victims were forced to watch everything that he did to them. Covering the floors were whips, chains, pulleys, straps, clamps, leg spreader bars, surgical blades, saws, and numerous sex toys. There was also a wooden contraption used to bend over and immobilize his victims while he and his friends would rape them. On the walls were detailed diagrams showing different methods and techniques for inflicting pain. In the trailer, the police also discovered a videotape showing a terrified woman being raped and tortured by David and Cindy. So after David Parker Ray was caught, the police asked him about why he would videotape his rapes. And he said, and I quote, "It was a source of entertainment for me to create these tapes. That's why there was a disclaimer at the beginning of the tape stating that it was for adult entertainment only." So after releasing some details about the woman in the video, she was identified by her ex-mother-in-law as Kelly Garrett, a former friend of David's daughter. On July 24th, your birthday.
Ugh.
This is not good though. On July 24th, 1996, after getting into a fight with her then-husband, Kelly decided to spend the night playing pool at a local saloon with David's daughter, Jessie.
You know what's weird? Her Kelly is spelled like
mine. I know.
Okay.
So Jessie roofied Kelly's beer, and she and her father placed a dog collar and a leash on her and brought her to his trailer. Yeah, it was...
Her friend did that?
Yeah. So, after they get her to the trailer, he then raped and tortured her for 2 days, keeping her on date rape drugs the entire time. After the 2 days were up, David slit her throat and dumped her on the side of the road. Miraculously, Kelly survived, but no one, neither her husband nor police, believed her story. In fact, her husband, believing that she had cheated on him that night, filed for divorce that year. Due to the effects of the drugs, Kelly had little recollection of the events over those 2 days, but she did remember being raped. With the publicity surrounding the arrest of David, another woman came forward with a similar story. Angelica Montano was an acquaintance of David's who, after visiting his house to borrow cake mix, had been drugged, raped, and tortured by him before being left alive by a highway out in the desert. There she was found by police, but they thought the story was so bizarre that the off-duty officer didn't believe her and thought she was making it up, so it never got reported and there was never any follow-up with her.
Imagine not being believed.
Right.
That's the problem I feel like with women who come forward, regardless if it's immediately or years later, they have to fear not being believed.
Mm-hmm.
Or someone not taking them seriously. Or them reporting it and no follow-up is done, no investigation is done because a police officer just... I just don't believe you.
Right, and you have to think the first girl, he slit her throat and she lived and they still didn't believe her. Like, she slit her own throat.
Right. I'm sorry, people don't just go out on the highway naked for fun.
Right.
Like, I'm just gonna, you'll find me when you find me, I'll be here naked.
With my throat slit.
With my throat slit. Or being dumped in New Mexico with...
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Okay, so at this point we know we've had three victims somehow survive this experience and no one believes them.
Right.
Except for the third who actually, when they actually got arrested. So David would often use drugs that would induce amnesia and memory loss in his victims, so they could not remember what had happened to them. With two victims testifying to the crimes, the police were able to put pressure on Cindy, who quickly folded and began telling what she knew of the murders. Her testimony led the police to discover that David had been helped in the abductions and murders by his daughter, Glenda Jessie Ray, and friend Dennis Roy Yancey. Dennis admitted to participating in the murder of Marie Parker, a woman who was abducted, drugged, and tortured for days by Ray and his daughter before Dennis strangled her to death in 1997. These drugs he would use, as well as the socioeconomic standing of many of the women involved, because most of them were prostitutes, made it difficult for their testimony to be readily accepted by jurors. As the investigation continued, evidence of more victims emerged. They also found photos of another victim in the trailer and animal bones buried in the nearby ground. Why that's significant, I don't know. David's trial began on March 28, 2000. Just after the jury selection was done, he suffered a heart attack and the trial was postponed. For some reason, the judge postponed the trial even further in order to try him for a 1996 murder in Colorado, even though the evidence wasn't very strong. A sheet listing routines for keeping prisoners was excluded, along with the torture devices in the toy box, since it couldn't be proven that they were in Ray's possession in 1996. On May 7th, 2000, shortly before or during Ray's trial, they weren't sure, for the Colorado murder, Angelica died of a drug overdose, taking her testimony to the grave. On May 23rd, 2000, the jury selection for Ray's new trial was finally done, and he was charged with 12 counts of kidnapping, sexual abuse, and conspiracy. In July, the judge declared a mistrial because the jury couldn't agree on a verdict. Not all of them were persuaded that the testifying victims had been held against their will.
Imagine hearing what they went through and just saying, I don't believe this was involuntary. What kind of human are you?
Right. So in November, a retrial began. A few days into it, the judge passed away. Yeah. The proceedings couldn't resume until next year in April. And this time, Ray was not as fortunate and was found guilty on all 12 charges. In June, his second trial began, with his daughter Jessie about to stand trial for helping her father kidnap Kelly Garrett. David offered to plead guilty to all of the remaining charges in exchange for Jessie's release. He was sentenced in 2001 to 223 years in connection with kidnapping and other charges involving two women who said he sexually tortured them at the residence. While David had never admitted to murder, he contacted authorities in May of 2002 to let them know he was willing to talk. A meeting was quickly scheduled, but David Parker Ray died of a heart attack before it ever took place on May 28, 2002, only 1 year into his sentence at the age of 62. With him dead, the case became a dead end. No bodies were ever found, and no possible victims were identified, and no old suspicious deaths related to him were ever officially linked to him. He's never been charged with a single murder. So his daughter, Jessie Ray, received a sentence of only 9 years. And in 2000, Cindy was given 36 years in prison, but after serving half of her sentence, she was eligible for parole and was released in 2019. Though Dennis Yancey refused to testify completely, he pled guilty to second-degree murder and conspiracy to commit first-degree murder and was sentenced to 30 years in prison. He was handed two 15-year terms. He was paroled in 2010, but violated his parole almost immediately, which sent him back to prison for his full sentence. He's scheduled to be released in 2021, and I never found anything saying whether he was or was not.
Ew.
In 2011, the FBI released hundreds of images of the items that were collected during the investigation, including the jewelry and women's clothing. The FBI statement read, "We are asking family and friends of missing people to look over these photographs and contact us if they recognize any of these items." So, to this day, there is no evidence to prove a single murder, even though he is believed to have killed as many as 60 or even up to 100 victims. Reporter Yvette Martinez told Killer Couples, no matter how many places they checked, they were never able to find any bodies. In their investigation of David's trailer, police found evidence of several more killings, including diaries written by him where he detailed the murder of at least 50 other women. The journal contained dozens of entries. There were no names, only dates and the number of times he tortured each victim. According to the New York Times, investigators collected more than 1,000 pieces of evidence, and despite the evidence, the authorities were unable to create cases from them. Regardless, with the three women who had come forward, there was enough evidence to convict the couple on more than 25 counts of kidnapping and rape. Facing prosecution, Cindy agreed to cooperate by testifying against David. She said she knew of at least 14 girls that he'd murdered. Prosecutor Jim Yount said David had told her of a body that he had disposed of in the lake, and that he had learned that when you put a body into the lake, even if you weigh the body down, you have to eviscerate the body cavity so that the air does not bring the body back up to the surface. But a search of the lake Elephant Butte, close to where they lived, failed to turn up any bodies. The lake they searched was 23 miles long and about 3 to 4 miles wide, with a depth of 90 to 100 feet in certain parts. Though Cindy and Dennis both identified areas they believed David disposed of these bodies, police found no human remains in any of these locations. The many unidentified personal effects and jewelry found in his trailer also point to a greater number of victims. "We're still getting good leads," FBI spokesman Frank Fisher said about the case in 2011. "As long as we're getting these leads, and as long as the exposure in the press keeps generating interest in the case, we're going to keep investigating this." In November of 2002, the toy box was opened to the public with the hope that it would lead to more surviving victims coming forward. In February of 2012, the Australian Federal Police contacted the FBI about a potential victim known only as Connie, who had been mentioned in a letter from a man named Mark that was postmarked in Sydney and was found in David's residence after his arrest. So, true to form, I got some Criminal Minds references for you, of course. So these are all in Criminal Minds about the toy box killer and his girlfriend. Season 2. While not directly mentioned or referenced in Season 2, Ray may have been an inspiration for Frank Breitkopf, No Way Out and No Way Out 2, The Evolution of Frank. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
You remember how Frank, they changed the details a little, but he would drug them and put the mirror up so they would have to watch.
Yep. Disturbing.
Mm-hmm. And it said both were abductors and, as suspected in Ray's case, prolific serial killers who abducted victims, usually female, even though Frank also targeted men in the show, and brought them back to a trailer to torture them. In the making of documentary for the season, Simon Murren said that the inspiration for Frank came from the story about an unnamed man who was found to have created his own autopsy room outfitted with torture instruments, video cameras, and a gynecology chair. While the basic concept is similar to Ray, he was never officially named as the inspiration of the episode.
I need to say this really quickly. As a female, once you've been in an official gynecologist office and an official gynecology chair during an exam, I don't know why these men that are serial killers find it so fascinating to have a chair like this. I promise you, you go do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You won't find it fascinating anymore. It's literally, that feels like torture.
It does.
And that's routine mm-hmm. for us women.
Exactly.
So imagine having to be in that chair and having things done to you, and you're seeing it, and it's involuntary. And then having someone or a peer jury of your peers or whatever you want to call it basically not believe you because of the choice of work, of work you're in. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're a stripper? Oh, you're a prostitute? Oh.
You don't matter.
We don't believe you.
Right.
This was totally by will.
Mm-hmm.
Come get out of here.
Disgusting. So then another episode with Criminal Minds Season 7 called True Genius, Ray was mentioned by Prentice in response to a question after a seminar. There was another in Season 7 called Unknown Subject. And while not directly mentioned or referenced in this episode, Ray appears to have been an inspiration for Hamilton Bartholomew, which, do you remember that one? So both were serial rapists and abductors who targeted women. Their attacks were so brutal, the women were left with horrible physical scars from the implements both rapists used, and at least one victim wasn't originally believed and lost much of their personal lives as a result of the brutality and the rejection and denial from the people around them, and also killed one woman by strangulation before leaving her to be found on a public route. So, very similar. And then another episode in Season 7 was called Profiling 101. Ray was mentioned by Morgan along with Efren Saldivar and John Robinson as an example of serial killers whose names have long been mostly forgotten due to the new serial killer cases that keep emerging. And then last but not least, Season 12. So the Crimson King, while not directly mentioned or referenced, David Parker Ray was confirmed to have been the inspiration for Daniel Cullen. Both were serial offenders who operated in Arizona and tortured their victims. And while Ray wasn't known to have forcibly engaged in BDSM with his victims, his homemade torture chamber was found to have a number of BDSM items, including spreader bars. This may have been referenced in the Crimson King through an aspect of Cullen's MO in which he chained his victims to arm stretchers.
I remember that one.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So I think the most disturbing thing to me about this one is that he's the first serial killer that nobodies have ever been found. But you've got journals detailing it. So imagine
detailing the murders that he also has never been charged for.
Mm-hmm.
Just kidnapping and rape.
And imagine the amount of families that are never going to have answers. I think that's what bothers me the most about it.
Can you imagine? And what I don't understand is if Cindy, his girlfriend, knows about the murders, and you know his daughter knows about a number of them.
And Dennis said he did too.
Why can't we apply pressure to them? Because he's already dead?
They've apparently done numerous searches with cadaver dogs and all kinds of stuff and have never even had a hit on a body. It's like, what was he doing with the bodies?
Right. Can you imagine the number of, like, to get 223 years is what he got?
Mm-hmm. Not for any
just
murder.
Just for kidnap and rape.
That's how bad the
alone.
Torture was, yeah.
What bothers me is that he died just 1 year into a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he should have rotted. Rotted.
And we literally talked about this. It always seems to be the worst people that live the longest and have the best
You're going to live... Like, how is he going to live a free life doing this crap to people and then die in prison 1 year into it?
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't seem like justice.
And you have to think, before he was even convicted and went to prison, he had had a heart attack the first time, so he was already in special care, kind of, in prison for that reason.
And why are we giving special care?
Right.
That might seem inhumane, but these people have genuinely ruined lives and families and killed people and done heinous acts.
And how backwards for him to get 223 years, but his daughter, who drugged and brought her friend to him, whose throat he slit, got 9 years.
Yeah.
9 years.
Yeah. She should have gotten at least half. It just doesn't. And we're going to put, there's pictures that Sam also has of all of the people and the toy box. All of this is going to be on our Instagram at co.signpodcast.
All right, guys, that is all we have for this week's episode. And we know this week was a little heavier than usual. All the true crime and serial killer cases are heavier, but some of them hit a little different. We do hope you enjoyed this episode. And like we said last week, if you know of a crazy killer couple case that you want us to discuss, send us a DM on Instagram or leave us a voice message via the link in our bio. You already know the drill. Go follow us on Instagram. At co.signpodcast, click the link in our bio to rate and review us on Apple. And like always, we will see you guys next week. Bye.
Oh my God.